You have to be able to construct a sense or a mechanism for startup like behavior to flourish within the organization. So I think the days are gone when as a 40 or a 50-year-old you are just doing something and you're going to continue to do it, right? I think everyone, including senior people in organizations, need to kind of discover a more kind of new and youthful way of working. And the best way to do that is to have people associated with startup-like projects, initiatives, whatever, within their organizations, and to use those to actually cut through silos which are about functions or silos which are about seniority levels, or silos which are about geographies, you know, really use those new startup-like initiatives, embed them into people's programs and professional journeys, and use it to, you know, create those melting pots.
Welcome to the 20th conversation of the Play to Potential podcast. This is a fortnightly series of reflective conversations with leaders across different fields on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and organizations and help them play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. I'm excited to announce that this podcast was recently awarded for innovation in digital publishing by DigiPub World. Thank you for the support over the last several months. My guest this time is Anu Madgaonkar, a partner with McKinsey Global Institute, the economics and business research arm of McKinsey & Company. As an alumnus of the firm, I was curious to connect with her to get her take on how she's navigated some of the phases in her life. She spoke about transitioning roles in banking, her move from banking to consulting when she joined McKinsey, how she juggled maternity and her career, how she transitioned from the consulting track to the MGI track, and more. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Anu.
Anu, thanks so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Lovely to be talking to you.
Maybe a good place to start is maybe talk a little bit about the McKinsey Global Institute and your role as an MGI partner. And I think what will be also valuable is what do you do, and more importantly, why do you do what you do?
Sure. So the McKinsey Global Institute is, we don't call it a think tank, but it's styled like a think tank. So it's a virtual organization that sits within McKinsey and focuses really on economics research. We are a global institute, which means that I have colleagues around the world, and collectively we produce maybe a dozen or so, maybe 15 or up to 20 major research reports on five or six core structural issues that we think are important in terms of the way businesses and policymakers need to think about the future of the world. And these span topics like technology and innovation and labor markets and financial markets. So how you really think about productivity, growth, competitiveness, what that means for your business. So this is sort of McKinsey's knowledge contribution and thought leadership, which we fund as a firm ourselves, and then we make that available to people for whom it's relevant, which is almost anyone. So we consider our audience to be very broad, actually.
Fair. And to answer the second question, what gives you a high in what you do?
I think two things about MGI, really. One is simply the nature of the problems that we try to address and understand. I think those problems are very fundamental. They're very ambiguous. They're very broad. So what is the future of work likely to be? Or what has made, you know, developing countries grow the way they have? And will that sustain going forward? Or how do you, you know, what is this concept of a minimum living standard that every human being should aspire to have? Very broad, very fundamental.
Also very disparate.
And what I love about it, actually, is it has relevance for business strategy. These questions have relevance for policy and government. And frankly, they have relevance for every human being as you think about your own life. So for me, it's intellectually very exciting to be part of MGI and have the opportunity to think about such things. And the second thing that is very wonderful about MGI is simply the global platforms that it opens us up to. So we're able to, I think, interact with the world's leading thinkers, opinion makers, influencers, right across the spectrum, largely economics focused, but nevertheless across geographies. And that is actually very exciting because you're exposed to simply the best.
Got it. Lovely. And maybe just to rewind the clock, I know one of the questions I ask all the people I talk to as part of this podcast is just a 3-4 formative experiences in your early years that still form a core part of who you are. I'd love your take on your journey and what do you think shaped a big portion of who Anu is today?
That's a great question. You're asking me to go back quite a long time, but I think it's a good question because formative experiences are much more important, I think, than we sort of credit them to be, right?
Hence the question, yeah.
Absolutely. So I think for me, there were three elements, I think, that really stand out. The first is my upbringing or the way my parents raised me, shall we say, was very anchored in a set of core values. So those one of the important values were integrity. You know, there were others. There was hard work. There was humility.
Sure.
But this acknowledgement that I need to live by my values and they are really important to the way I live actually came at a very young age. My dad, for example, was in the Indian Administrative Service. He took the idea of integrity and honesty to such an extreme that I remember our newspapers, like, you know, the newspaper that came to the house every day, there were not as many newspapers as there are today. There were a couple. But
more meaningful papers in those days, though.
Yeah, absolutely. But the bills were paid by the government, right? So the government would pay for the newspaper. And my dad always believed that therefore they are government property. And at the end of the month, all the collected papers would be sent back so that the government could sell them and, you know. And therefore, for a school project, if we needed to make newspaper cuttings, we had to go out and buy a newspaper that we would cut and use for our own work. So simple, small things like that, which just underscore that this is the way we are. This is what we believe. And there are really no, you know, there are no issues about adhering to those values.
Sure.
So I think that was one important bedrock. The second principle, I think, again, they instilled in me was to say that it doesn't matter what you do, but you have to find what you want to do and then really work hard at doing it well. So there was, I think I grew up in a system in those days, more for most of us, I think engineering and medicine were the only two really respected career choices. And if you didn't do those, you were considered, you know, not so smart or not so academically, you know, superior, right?
You're putting it mildly. You're a social outcast.
That's certainly one way of putting it. But for me, that was a particularly kind of important issue because my brother, I had an older brother who was 5 years ahead of me on this academic track. And when he was 17, he took the joint entrance exam to get into IIT. And it so happened that he was ranked number one in the country.
Wow.
So I grew up with that. And I had a host of cousins who all went through the IIT.
That was,
you know, the norm, right? So you had to do that. But my parents actually said, you don't have to do that. You can do whatever you want. And I ended up doing a BA degree, which was practically like, you know, you're a social outcast if you do it. But that's what they encouraged me to do. And I think that was very refreshing for me because through life, this notion around it doesn't really matter what others think is the thing to do. You have to really figure out what you want to do, I think came at a very young age. And then the third formative experience, I am happy to say that with all this super idealistic upbringing I had, there was also a voice of reason. And that came from a very unexpected quarter. So after I graduated, I had a degree in economics and I was wondering what to do next. And I had gotten into the IIMs, but I was also toying with this idea of, you know, maybe I should, you know, go and do like a master's in economics or something completely different. You know, there was this slightly romantic idea of what else I would like to do. And then there was this cousin of mine who was no particular influence in my life at that point. But out of the blue, he just said that, you know, you're a girl and you should remember that it is very important for you to be financially independent because you don't know what your circumstances are going to be. You should be able to earn your own living and live well and stand on your own feet. So whatever you do needs to be marketable and have value in the in an economic sense, right?
Understood.
That was not a message I got from my parents at all, because they were fundamentally, believers that life works itself out, just do what you like. But I got this hard-nosed input from a cousin, and I think that was pivotal, actually, because I did decide to go to the IIMs and then have a conventional career, and, you know, making money was part of that set of objectives that I set out to do myself.
Very interesting. And back to the formative years, it's interesting that economics has reappeared. We'll talk about that in a minute, but I think that's the other takeaway, where clearly there was some little bird chirping away about economics.
Absolutely. Some spark of interest that
eventually got heard.
Absolutely.
But lovely. And maybe just cutting to the current, given your growth as a leader and the discussions around cultivating more women leaders, any specific insights on the role of parenting in the context of shaping women leaders? You already alluded to a couple of points around economic independence and, making the choice. But any other insights around, specifically around the commentary around women leadership, what do you see as a role of parenting in sort of ensuring that the early years are sort of spent in creating the right wiring for the future?
Sure. So I think, I'm a parent myself. So I react to this question now less as an emerging woman leader and thinking about how I should grow or evolve, but more as in my role as a parent, what are the things that I can do, right?
Sure.
And I think that simply this notion of within the home, the kind of dynamics within members of the household are really, really important, because there are a whole lot of subliminal messages that get conveyed and kind of get buried deep into the unconscious of not just the girl, but also the boy who's growing up in that home. So both aspects are very important. I know a lot of people who take pride in raising their girls in a way that is feminist and, that says that I brought up my girl not to believe she's less than any man, which is great. And I do that as well. But it's equally important to have that role modeling for your son.
Right.
So for the son to see parents not playing super gendered roles. When I look at my own husband, I know that his parents actually didn't play gender stereotype roles. Both of them worked. And as it happened, his father was the one who was a gourmet and interested in food, and he ran the kitchen. Whereas my mother-in-law had no interest in doing that, and she didn't do it. And as a result, I think their kids grew up just a lot more comfortable with different aspects and different roles that you play in life and not thinking about it in such a gendered way. So I think these are really, really important. And, the more as parents we try and just be sensitive to that, I think the better.
And moving forward, Anu, IMA happened. And post-IMA, you pursued a career in equity research for 7 years, 91 to 98. And then you moved to McKinsey. So talk about that transition. How did it come about? And, again, having moved here, talk to us a little bit about what you had to learn and unlearn, given that transition.
Sure. So I went through a couple of career transitions, actually, before coming to McKinsey. So there were three of them. Mm-hmm. My first job was actually in banking.
Right.
And I was a foreign exchange. I was on the foreign exchange treasury trading desk.
Yeah.
Right. So I did that for a couple of years. But for me, that wasn't me. I was not super excited about trading. Taking risk, making money. That was just not super exciting. What I really wanted, or what excited me more, was the sort of knowing something about something. So I really felt like I wanted to understand a topic, a theme, a set of problems. And I guess it was the more analytical part of me that was wanting a switch. So I switched then. I was a credit analyst for some time, and then I was an equity analyst for some time. And those roles were more about thinking and analysis and understanding, becoming a sort of, somebody who knew something about that area and was able to communicate it well.
Got it.
So I enjoyed that. But there was an externally prompted crisis, actually, that made me think about shifting tracks. Life might have been different had 1998's Asian financial crisis not happened.
Right.
But it did happen. And the investment bank I was working for actually went bust. They had a lot of debt on their books, which went belly up. And then I had a genuine choice about what to do next. And there were other options in the equity analyst space that I had offers and I could have. But it did feel to me that, you know, here's a chance to try something different. And McKinsey was an interesting unknown space that I was just curious about. Frankly, it was pure curiosity that prompted me to, you know, apply to McKinsey. I remember that when I got the offer, the compensation was actually significantly lower than what I would have got elsewhere. And everyone I talked to said, why on earth would you do this? But I was just curious. I said, it doesn't matter. I just want to know. This is a space that's known for, you know, excellence. So I want to see what it's like. I don't, probably won't last there too long, but, you know, why not try it now, right? Sure. This is an inflection point in my life. And that's the motivation with which I joined McKinsey. And of course, I stayed here for over 15 years as it happened. But
sure. And once again, having sort of experienced consulting and having seen banking, different facets of banking rather, I go back, again, rewind the clock back to, let's say, graduating from IMA. Consulting and banking, I think, still are two very coveted paths. And I'm curious about your take on how students should think about the two options. And I realize that sometimes there's no substitute to learning through experience. But at that time, most people are academically qualified but possibly haven't worked. So what's your take on the questions people should ask themselves to see which path might be more appropriate?
I think there are a few fundamental differences between the two paths, right? I think in consulting, what you actually get is a sort of, first and foremost, an opportunity to be in a university for life or a university of life kind of environment where your learning curve in terms of a whole host of different skill sets is very steep. In banking, of course, in every occupation you learn. So I'm not trying to say you don't learn elsewhere. But in consulting, it's a very 360 degree skill development on a very accelerated track. So we like to think that we, you know, work with people who come out of business schools and then in 5 or 6 years, they are holistic leaders, right? So how does that very accelerated process happen? It's through apprenticeship and learning from others. But
and you're at the bleeding edge of the problems the world is trying to solve, right? In the spirit of...
You completely are. And there is also a lot of variety because, you know, at least for a good chunk of your initial years, you're not dedicated to any one area. So you don't know, frankly, where your path will lead you, but you have the opportunity to figure that out. So that's part of this university of life kind of idea. The second, I think, really fundamental difference is that in consulting, you are, it is the business of making other people successful.
Right.
And you have to be very comfortable with that, committed and energized by that. And equally, you have to be very energized and comfortable about working within teams in a very collaborative environment. So if that doesn't make you tick, then you should think hard about it because this is a people business, both internally as well as the clients we work with. And it is about making other people successful, both externally and internally. Actually, each of us as McKinsey leaders, it's all about how helpful you are to make other people in McKinsey successful. So that is, I think, you don't quite think about it that way if you're outside, but when you're inside, you do realize that this is what it takes.
And interesting. So back to sort of distill it to the questions. One is clearly the sort of the learning curve piece that you spoke about. Second is the people element, which is often less understood. The problem solving element is often better understood.
Exactly.
Is there any other element of the journey in banking or consulting which is not as well understood in the path?
I think for me, one interesting observation that I had is that in consulting, and maybe this is true to some extent, again, in banking, I'm not trying to minimize that, but I did feel that in consulting, the ability to zoom in and go very, very granular into problems, but equally through that process, zoom out and synthesize and really step back and say, what is the big takeaway? What are we really saying? What does this all mean? So the zoom in, zoom out aspect of what you're required to do, both are equally important. I don't think people fully appreciate that. A lot of people may think consulting is all about, you know, the very exciting strategy bit, but without understanding that you really have to do, you really have to understand how a process works. So you, you know, you might be in a mine trying to figure out how to improve productivity, or you might be taking a credit scoring process and, you know, figuring it out at the nth levels. But the zoom in is really important, but then the zoom out is equally important because you can't be in the weeds.
Got it.
And this is, I think, part of the problem solving process, which is exciting and not so well understood outside.
Interesting. And moving the clock forward, Anu, I want to sort of come to the associate principal point. And I understand that's around the time you were expecting or you had your first child. So talk to us a little bit about how you thought about your choices at that point, thought about your different priorities at that point.
So I have to say, first of all, that I never thought about myself as a woman consultant or a woman professional up until that point. So it just wasn't an issue. In fact, a little anecdote is that when I was being interviewed out of IMA for my first job, one of the interviews I did was actually with a woman who was very senior in her organization. And the interview was going swimmingly well, and I was answering some fairly technical question, I remember, when she suddenly interrupted and she said, "What will happen after you get married? Will you still work?" And I have to say that such a question had not even crossed my mind. So I sat there like a deer in the headlights. And then I just said, you know, I don't even know how to answer this question because I never thought it would be an issue ever, right? So one doesn't really, the short point is that you can't really anticipate what it is like to go through a life stage until you are in that life stage. And for me, therefore, I didn't really think about options. I said, you know, let me just go through it, have the baby. And I was given this advice by everybody to say, you don't have to be sure what you will feel like 3 months down the road or 6 months down the road or 2 weeks down the road. You don't have to make that decision about when you come back. You know, go through it. You've not experienced this before. And the wonderful part about the firm was that they said, we are always here. So you figure out what works for you and don't prejudge and preempt because you've not experienced this before. That's advice I took to heart. So that is exactly what I did. The first time I had, you know, my first child, I took, you know, a year off. And then I came back through a lot of different, experimented with a lot of different flexible options. But for me, the big thing was don't feel under pressure to prejudge or know. And it might well have been that I would have felt ready much earlier, right? So there was no point really, you know, trying to
cognitively solve it.
Yeah, exactly.
I had the experience.
Exactly. Right,
with you. And do you want to double click on the experiments? The reason I ask is sometimes, specifically around maternity as a transition, is I do believe that sometimes people see it as a binary decision. Do something else, stay, come back to the organization. But often there is a opportunity to figure out what the different possibilities could be. So talk to us a little bit about how you thought about different experiments at that stage.
Well, I was fortunate in that a couple of things happened. I think one thing was that because I was in the consulting profession, paradoxically maybe to what people expect, it actually offers you a lot of flexibility options. It is more flexible than many other professions might be. Secondly, I think I was in an environment where they were keen to make this work for me, and therefore there were no boundary conditions or ground rules. I was told to craft whatever option worked for me. So I had a lot of choice and I could figure it out, right? So what were the options? There was clearly one path that said, well, I don't want to work full time. I do want to work part time. But the conventional model of part time, which is I work 4 days, I take 1 day off in the week, that doesn't work because children don't follow. Babies certainly don't follow that clock, right? So we worked out a much more flexible model in which I would broadly work 60% of my time, but have the ability to step back and do whatever I needed to at the times that more or less worked for me, provided, you know, it worked for the team also. There was a bit of give and take, but it wasn't very rigid, right? So I did that for some time. Then there came a time where I, you know, my husband was actually living in Hong Kong at the time, and I was in Bombay with my baby, and I wanted some time flexibility to be able to spend time in Hong Kong and then come back. So we crafted something where I would work on a client engagement for a short period, maybe 3 months, and then I would withdraw and, you know, take off and go to Hong Kong and spend, you know, 3 weeks there and then come back and then do something else.
Got it.
So we modularized it so that I could take breaks between the work that I did. And then there were many other options as well along the way. But the The interesting thing is that now, you know, we've actually given lovely brand names and lots of, you know, formalization this, to all of the options.
These are packaged.
These are all packaged. They're a menu of things. But we still give people the message that if you want to craft something else, which is outside of this or a combination of these, feel free to do that. Because we think about every woman here as a segment of one. Right? We are going to solve for you. So let's figure out what it will take to solve for you and make that flexibility happen.
It's interesting you say this segment of one. But just sticking to this theme of maternity being a big transition for women, I was talking to Zia Modi a couple of weeks back, and I was talking to her about the leaky pipeline, which is much talked about. And she basically, as is well understood, said that the point of maternity is where the point of maximum slippage is. So just flipping it around, Anu, again, making it maybe a little more general, not just McKinsey, but what are the typical missed opportunities or mistakes you see women leaders make in terms of how they deal with maternity as a transition? Any reflections on what you've seen some of your batchmates or some of your other peers in the industry, your observations on how they grapple with it? Any reflections on the opportunities there?
I think two or three things, right? I think one is sometimes they feel under pressure to come back very quickly. Now, I'm not saying that the longer you stay away, the better it is. That's certainly not the case, right? Because you do get out of touch and it's harder to come back. But at the same time, there is a certain stabilization of your own, you know, personal state of mind and your domestic situation. And that kind of stability does take sometimes a little time.
The new equilibrium, right?
The new equilibrium, right? To get comfortable in that and then come back. Because if you come back, if you just feel under a lot of pressure and want to rush back and you don't have that piece sorted, then it's just not very healthy for you. So I think, just think about that a little bit. The second thing, the mistake, right, that that I do see people make is this anxiety that, or this very sort of batch-driven mindset, right? It might be a little bit unique to India, but there is this sense that, you know, I'm part of a batch and my peers are getting ahead of me. So there is this linearity.
With a manufacturing date and an expiry date. And,
exactly. And, and therefore a linear path. That everybody is charging down this path. And if I'm not sort of jumping back onto it and running twice as hard, you know, people are going to get ahead of me and that sets me, you know, I've lost the race, right? I think you have to break out of that very linear mindset. There is no linear path. There are a multitude of paths. And you literally have one life to try and do the things that you want. So grasp this opportunity, get rid of this batch mindset and do the things that you want. They may or may not be strictly, you know, benchmarked with your batchmates. But, you know, this is your life, right? So you should explore the things that you want and kind of use this opportunity to do some of those things. And I don't find that a lot of people sort of do that. And then the third mistake that we might make sometimes is just thinking about life as a bit of a sprint, as opposed to saying, you know, there are, you know, you should have a mindset that says there are a set of medium-term goals for me. It's not about right now, right? I have to sustain, I have to renew myself. I have to be able to sustain my balance and my lifestyle and feel energized. And that is what makes me productive and successful over a 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year time frame. And, you know, by the way, I'm going through maternity. The children are with me for, you know, maybe a 30-year time frame, right, before you finally let go of them.
Sure.
You don't know when that'll happen. But, you know, we're in it together for the long haul. And therefore, to think about balance in a little bit, with a slightly longer term perspective than a lot of people adopt.
Got it. Got it. And I want to sort of now maybe get you to wear your MGI hat and ask you about the notion of gender equality. I know you've done a study in 2016, was it? I'm just curious about the big takeaways from that piece of work in terms of aspiring women leaders. What's your take on, you know, findings from that, informing how people should think about careers?
So I think one of the big findings from that piece of work was simply that it actually really matters in terms of economic output to the world or to a nation or to any part of the economy, it really, really matters to be able to harness women, bring them into the workforce, keep them there in the long run, engaged, and to create diversity in leadership. So it is a problem which is not just a nice to have, but it's a must have. If your basic model of economic growth has to be vibrant, right? There is a huge price attached to it. We sized it at least $12 trillion worldwide of incremental output. Not if all women were in the workforce, but even if rates of women's participation improved, based on comparable benchmarks. So even based on a realistic set of assumptions, this is like a huge deal. So that was, I think, takeaway number one. I think takeaway number two was that if you look at a whole lot of macro indicators, it is very, very clear that what each of us women feel at a very personal level, which is that I have, you know, all of these personal roles to fulfill, wife, mother, daughter-in-law, daughter, whatever, on the one hand, and then I have work on the other hand. And how do I really make the two sing together, right? So this is a very personal dilemma. But the interesting part is when you look at the macro statistics, you know, social equality and the social and societal role played by women in different parts of the world. We looked at 100 countries, but social roles were very correlated with economic equality. So the two need to go hand in hand. And therefore, the more you think about driving gender equality in education, in healthcare, in media, in politics, in terms of domestic chores, in terms of, you know, childcare support, so your role in the families, you have to really think about equality on many of those dimensions in order for workforce equality to also drive. And then the implication for organizations or businesses is that, you know, you have to therefore adopt a fairly holistic approach to thinking about helping make women successful. It is really important for you to do that. And you have to therefore tackle and address a lot of things at the level of unconscious beliefs and biases that we have at every point along the pipeline, whether it's in terms of recruiting or promoting or creating opportunities. There are biases, societal mindsets, which both women have as well as men in the organization. So you have to systematically tackle those. But I also believe, and maybe this didn't come out of the research, but as we look more and more at businesses, that you need to solve for these, not just, it's not just a women's issue, right? Many of these choices or tackling biases or tackling mindsets are equally true for men working in the organization. So you can't have a system in which, you know, women get a lot of flexibility and rights, but men don't have them, because that creates, you know, weird dynamics of a different nature.
Right. So sort of the, borders and paternalizing the situation.
Exactly, exactly. It's not only a woman's job to raise children, right? It is as much. And by the way, men, many men want to do it, but societal biases don't permit them to fulfill those roles, right? So you actually have to move to being the kind of business organization that inculcates a much more equal gendered approach. And similarly, I think for the economy overall.
Interesting. And even at a micro level, if I go back to your early years, I guess in a way it sort of reflects on the fact that it's not just what you do with your daughter, but it's also what you do with your son, which is going to shape the culture of the family and their mindsets.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
If I may sort of tie it back to that. Just moving on to a different theme, Anu, this notion of just navigating one's career and sort of back to your point about the bespokeness of our respective journeys. So talk to us a little bit about how you've thought about that. And again, if I were to sort of maybe link it to a strategy question that businesses often ask, where to play, how to win, I guess leaders often ask where to go and how to grow. And I see a lot of commentary around how to grow, but I find not as much conversation around where to go. So talk to us a little bit about how you've thought about the where to go question in the context of what you were solving for at different points in time. And I specifically ask that because you've sort of you have the unique distinction of having made partner in the traditional track, then you made a bunch of choices, and now you got re-elected in the MGI track. So talk to us about just this whole piece of navigation over the last few years.
Yeah, I think the navigation is important it was certainly important for me as I sought, that the holy grail of work-life balance. But I think this navigation and the choices we make are actually relevant for everybody, regardless of your so-called personal or life circumstances. And this is because I feel that there is a sense of renewal and a sense of just tapping into your own energy that keeps you going, that every professional actually needs to be aware of and has to take stock of every few years to say, is my sense of energy high, right, about what I'm doing. Now, for me, that sense of energy came, I think, a lot from being intellectually excited about the problems that I was looking at. So at every major transition that I made, the move from, the trading desk to credit and equity research was prompted by wanting to kind of challenge my mind in a different way. The curiosity that made me get into consulting. And then finally, I found that as a consultant, I'd spent many years looking at the financial services sector. And because I was not very mobile, I had a family, etc., I ended up looking at this in the context of, a certain, I looked at India, I looked at other emerging markets. But over a period of time, I found that that wasn't, exciting me enough. Mm-hmm. And there could have been other options for intellectual growth and renewal, but the McKinsey Global Institute option came my way, which was fascinating because it was completely different. And as I said earlier, it afforded me the opportunity of looking at huge problems that you don't normally think about, right? In a very fundamental way. So I think making a transition necessitates you just self-reflecting a little bit to say, what is it that I really am looking for that will make me tick, and give me the energy I need, right, to make kind of the next phase of growth happen for me. For me, it was all about making, finding the right source of intellectual challenge and doing so by making these different transitions.
And if I may double-click on that to persist with the theme, and the reason I do it is, I think even when I go back to days at IMA and some of the other education I've been through, I think a lot of the education is focused around solving the, making sense of the outer world. But solving the inner world is often left to chance. So just to make it tactical, if you had to sort of decode the how of how you figured out what makes you tick, are there any thoughts on, how people could make sense of the inner world to get to the bottom of what makes them tick?
That's a really difficult question.
Not that there's a silver bullet, but I'm just curious about, if somebody came and asked you the question, I'm not sure what makes me tick. What's the sort of the one or two, lines of inquiry you would suggest they undertake to get to the bottom of that?
So my advice would be to talk to a few people, and I go back actually to a moment of epiphany that I had in a very unexpected place, which was when I was being interviewed by one of the most senior partners in McKinsey 15 years ago or more, when I was applying to join the firm. And I had had a series of interviews which went fine, and then this very, very senior partner was sitting there, and he said, asked me a little bit about my career goals or something like that. And I started telling him about how I enjoyed every aspect of my professional journey so far, except this one particular phase. And he stopped me dead in my tracks, and he just, in a very penetrating way, he said, "Why did you not enjoy that phase?" And sitting in that interview, actually, I went through a moment of complete self-awareness. I was not aware of this, but because he asked me that pointed question, I took a couple of minutes to think about it, and then I came back and I said, as I think about everything, I discovered in that phase that I'm not fundamentally a very competitive person. I'm much more a collaborative person, and that situation demanded a level of competitive behavior that I was not very comfortable with. Which I was not aware of earlier. So I think having that conversation with someone who provoked me to think was actually very helpful. Not everyone provokes you to think, but, seek that out in your mentors, or seek that out in, your couple of close relationships. That's all I would say. You know, get to that level of conversation because that's what actually provokes you to reflect.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And the related question, Anu, is sort of for a minute, the traditional consulting path and the MGI path. Again, what have you had to learn and unlearn in sort of moving from, let's say, the one track to the other?
I think the a couple of things are different about the MGI work that we do. Mm. One of the things which is quite different is that in consulting, there is very, very tightly iterative problem solving and the ability to bounce off the work that you do with your clients or other experts in a very short cycle. Mm. So it's short cycle, iterative, and you get feedback and you go back and refine your answer. In MGI, it's research. So our projects are longer. We have to go much deeper. The questions we solve are ill-defined. I'd say they're very vaguely defined because we don't quite know what we're doing. So we take a lot more time before we then surface and do the rounds of iteration. So that took a little bit of getting used to because you can get lost meandering along.
The rhythm is very different.
Yeah. The rhythm is very different and you can literally get lost doing stuff that's, you know, so esoteric before you draw yourself back and say, let me bounce this off someone and see if I'm on the right track, right? So I think that was one piece that was that was different. And then I think the other piece, which is new and different in my role, is that the focus on writing skills is much more in this role. I think in consulting, there's a lot of verbal communication, convincing people and getting people to act in a certain way, right?
Sure.
So there's a different set of communication skills. But here, I think it is stuff which has a shelf life of 5 to 10 years. People will hold you to it. And what you say and how you say it is actually matters a lot more, right? In terms of communication skills.
Got it. And back to your earlier point about getting lost in this context of this open-ended nature of seemingly relatively open-ended nature, shall we say. How do you walk the tightrope of taking on something that's big and significant, but at the same time taking on something that's sort of, you know, let's say tangible and scopable? Where do you draw the line?
I think we try and assemble each of our project teams is assembled within an ecosystem where you get, you know, pushes or challenges that force you in case you kind of wander off too much in the esoteric direction or in case you are just too tactical and not really focused on solving the fundamental issues. You want the checks and balances and the intellectual challenge to come through the research project. The way we do that is we have a panel of academic advisors who are typically, you know, leading economic thinkers, including some Nobel laureates. So we have those kinds of folk who advise us on our projects. We also typically have a much more practitioner type of advisory panel. So business guys or folks in government who keep us very grounded to, you know, what is practical, what is realistic, what is useful to know, right? And then we try and have a rhythm of, you know, getting inputs and setting up because
those two magnetic forces
ensure that you know somewhere. Absolutely. We're honest, but at the same time we're kind of tangible and useful, right?
Very interesting. Very interesting. And just moving to a different theme of, you know, another piece of work that MGI has published, which is about the future of work. I'm just talking, I'm curious about the so what from an individual standpoint, specifically how do we navigate the future of work? So maybe to start, what are the big takeaways in terms of how the future of work is going to be very different from today? And secondly, therefore, what does it mean for the individual that sort of in the workplace of today to be future ready?
I think the nature and shape of work is going to change very dramatically, right? If we, based on a lot of work that MGI has done on this topic globally, I can definitely say that we have a good understanding of what technology is capable of today. But despite that, I think we, like everybody else, is constantly surprised at the pace at which these technology capabilities are advancing. So just in the realm of, you know, AI and automation, the kind of very human-like capabilities, whether it's, you know, Google's AlphaGo program that beat a world master Go player in a game that is not mechanical but actually demands a lot of creativity and intuition. Or the way, face recognition or speech recognition technology is beating the best human experts at this. Not just beating them by far, but doing so in a manner which is very learning oriented. So these are programs that are learning constantly and improving. So the whole nature of what these, AI and automation technologies are able to do is...
It's not a static comparative advantage.
It's not a static,
something that's going to get steeper and steeper.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So given that, if you map those technology capabilities against the capabilities that we as workers are using in our jobs, in our occupations, we use a mix of technologies. I use, physical dexterity. I use sensing capabilities. Sure. I use emotional capabilities. I use logical reasoning capabilities. A whole spectrum of different capabilities.
Yeah.
So our research actually maps what are the best available technological capabilities today and to what extent they fulfill. Are they already at top quartile performance level for, let's say, fine motor skills? Or are today's technologies at top quartile level for emotional and, more
in terms of machines versus humans?
Versus humans.
Wow.
So if you map that, you actually come up with this really startling conclusion. First of all, it's not about jobs. It's about parts of a job.
Correct.
So not all of my work can get automated, but parts of it certainly can. And if you look at the way we as a workforce around the world spend our time using these capabilities and compare that with technology, we find that 50 to 55% or maybe 45 to 55%, something in a band like that, is the technical automation capacity that already exists in the world today. It doesn't mean that all of this will get automated because
economic
feasibility,
cost,
et cetera, et cetera. So in reality, you might not see adoption rising that steeply. But it's a very sobering thought to say that a lot of what you do is actually, could be substituted. And the things that can be less easily substituted are the more creative aspects of, the work that we do. The new pattern recognition. So not sort of recognizing an established pattern. I think machines can do that much better. But it's sort of finding new patterns, right, where they did not exist earlier. Also, the whole interaction, the leadership, managing other people, so more emotional and sensing types of skills.
Right.
And what is really interesting is that the education system is not oriented to creative skills. It is not oriented to emotional and sensing or interpersonal or leadership skills. We are still, even we who pride ourselves on being, maybe an education system that encourages math and science and STEM skills. But if you really look, are you really teaching problem solving skills which involve these kinds of things to your kids? Or are you still, doing STEM in a very mechanical way? And I would say that the education system is just not ready for this. And therefore, I think the advice to both organizations as well as, frankly, parents who are raising children is that the more we are going to challenge our workforce and encourage environments in which you can think more creatively and more openly, I think that is the only way of really future-proofing yourself. So this is one big bucket of the future of work. I think the other really interesting dynamic playing out from our research is this whole... We think about flexibility as, maybe like for women, this is important or whatever. But the reality is that there is a whole generation of younger people who want to be independent, autonomous and flexible workers. A lot of them, we did some surveys in the US and Europe, a lot of them, up to 70% of them actually want to do this by choice. So this is not that I'm forced to be in a flexible work model because I don't have a formal job offer. But 70% of them value the flexibility that comes from being an autonomous worker of some kind. So if that is the case, then and as an organization, you have to figure out that this is what people want.
And how do you engage with that?
Yeah, the old org structure of, a bunch of full-time workers dedicated to one time. You put the two things together. People are going to have to be more creative and flexible, but they're also going to want to work in a more autonomous slivered, different. So you need to create an organization that actually allows that to happen.
Back in the future of the firm, right? In a way, it's interesting. Actually, I was talking to another leader, Ravi Venkatesan, in a different context. And the question I asked him, I remember, was, we're living in a world with reduced transaction costs between organizations given technology and platforms. So what does it mean in terms of the future of the organization? But his point was, in such an ecosystem, trust becomes more important. And, you know, and the pendulum will swing back, because the reason organizations exist is because you have a certain hiring standard, people belong to a certain work ethic, blah, 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 and that signals something. And sort of there's a certain sort of minimal friction when people within an organization work. But when ecosystems start working together, there's going to be more friction.
There's going to be more friction and dissonance of different styles. And
So I think to make it real for the leaders of today, again, if you had to reflect on the two questions, where do I go and how do I grow? So how should leaders think about navigation, and how should they think about developing the capability given these developments? Any takes on how leadership development should evolve in this context?
I think there has to be a part of navigating yourself as well as navigating, you know, for people in the organization that you're leading. You have to be able to construct a sense or a mechanism for you know, startup like behavior to flourish within the organization. So I think the days are gone when, as a 40 or a 50 year old, you are just doing something and you're going to continue to do it, right? I think everyone, including senior people in organizations, need to kind of discover a more kind of new and youthful way of working, and the best way to do that is to have people associated with startup-like projects, initiatives, whatever, within their organizations, and to use those to actually cut through silos which are about functions, or silos which are about seniority levels, or silos which are about geographies, you know, really use those new startup-like initiatives, embed them into people's programs and professional journeys, and use it to, you know, create those melting pots, put, you know, more experienced people in with. It's very, very refreshing, and I can't think of a better way actually to.
And any examples that come to mind of companies that have done it well?
Well, I think frankly, in the Indian setup, a lot of companies, without naming names, but companies that have gone through explosive growth, say in the financial services space that I've had the privilege of observing, right, over the last decade or so, simply because growth opportunities were exploding. And you had kind of mid-career people actually jumping on to a completely new business opportunity because regulation now allowed you to do it, for example. And they're kind of inventing, not reinventing, but inventing a business model along with, you know, younger folk who've come in, or people with technology skills who've come in. But I think we've seen a lot of that. I think the organizations that have flourished the most, at least as you think about the financial services space, are those where people have been forced to get into business building mode, for better or for worse, and, you know, build businesses from scratch. If the environment doesn't force you to do that, as they were forced to in financial services, then I think organizations should force a little bit of that kind of thinking internally, at least.
And I think you sort of alluded to people in their 40s and 50s. In a way, while the younger generation, in a way, is sort of breathing this new way of being, if you will, I guess this is a profound shift for a lot of people who've experienced education and career in a certain paradigm, which is sort of beginning to become obsolete in a lot of ways. So tactically, how do you, and this is not just a superficial shift, it's a mindset shift in terms of how they behave, how they conduct, how they spend time, how they lead, how they make choices. Are there one or two guiding thoughts in terms of how people could shift their mindsets to cope better in the future?
I think it comes back to this forcing people to learn new mindsets by putting them in situations that actually expose them to and demand those mindsets. And I've, you know, we've seen, for example, approaches in which the development of leaders happens through a lot of the way people think about leadership development is, you know, send them for a course, right? Executive management program, and, you know, learn some new skills and then come back. But the problem with that is it's a very theoretical set of inputs, and you come back, it's business as usual, right?
And you said it's skills. It's not mindset.
It's skills. Yeah, exactly. So I think it comes back to what I said earlier, which is, can we embed into people's professional goals, not just delivering on the BAU target, but also something, some component, maybe 10% of your time or your energy or your resources have to be in being part of a completely new bottom-up initiative, right? And you can do that at different levels in the organization, but you know, if you're forcing people at least 15% of their time or 10% of their time to be part of something completely different from the BAU running of whatever book or whatever product line you're running, that will challenge you in many, many different ways.
Got it. So lovely, Anu. Just a few questions to wrap up. The first is, again, rewinding the clock, given we're alumni of IMA. Three things they don't teach in IMA but should teach, given the journey you've been on.
Sure. I think it comes back a little bit to your opening question, which is what are the formative influences, and then a little bit around the future of work, right? At least two things, if not three. I think one is it's a world where you know, risk is rising at an exponential in an exponential way. There are risks from so many different, you know, there's much more volatility, and small things you do in the organization can have big implications because of interconnectedness and many other things, right? Mm-hmm. Complexities. So an understanding of risk, and in that context, kind of ethics and ethical behavior. Very important to sensitize, you know, people at an early stage in their career. It's not something at least we were really exposed to. And then you end up, you know, kind of discovering that what you do in an organization can have severe ramifications, right? So the kind of risk plus ethics, kind of more awareness on those kinds of dimensions.
And what sort of risks are you referring to, just for me to understand, to
make it simple specific? Simple things, right? I mean, loose talk, for example. I mean, if you travel around in an elevator, are you sort of mindful of what is sensitive information and how you should be talking about it?
Understood.
I think this is a very basic sort of awareness that people need to build into themselves. And then there are many, many more like that. But I think you've got to be more aware of how to conduct yourself in the context of an environment which is, you know, which has more risk and more sensitivity around many things.
Sure.
So that I think is one. The second is, I think while I think in the IIMs we did do a lot of group work, and you know, we did work in teams, but I just feel that there was not enough, or there can be much more cross-functional and creative types of projects, right? So we come back to the future of work. If it is really about trying to think about problems in a multi-dimensional way, are we really encouraging those kinds of skills in the context of what we do, or are we still kind of mired in, you know, the more traditional mindset of how to solve a problem? Right?
Correct. In a lot of ways, it's often quite functional in terms of the lens you use to look at a certain situation. A related question, if you had to speak to the graduating women of IMA today, what are some of the themes you would leave them with in terms of how they should think about the journey ahead?
So first, I would say they should have a strong sense of optimism. Literally, there are, you know, unimaginable possibilities for them, much more than there used to be. And they should certainly feel that they have the right to, you know, go ahead and forge their own path. So that is the first thing. Let no one kind of tell you that, you know, you need to make the choice that I was asked, at least in the interview, right? You know, will you work after you get married? Such things are, you know, not even something that should cross your mind, right? There's a lot you can do. The second thing I would say is that you should actually, you know, mentorship and sponsorship is very important for professional success. By mentorship, I mean the kind of people who will provoke you to think in a certain way. And who will support you, right? Sponsorship is people who will create opportunities for you and, you know, help you be successful by real tangible opportunity creation. Both these are very important. So I would say that don't minimize the role that mentors and sponsors will play in life. Be aware of who could be, you know, people who can play that role. They may come from unexpected quarters, but, you know, be aware and kind of build those networks and relationships.
And lean into that opportunity.
Yeah, lean into the opportunity. This is not about, you know, you like a solitary, you know, tower of, you know, strength trying to kind of, you know, forge your own path. This is about actually a network and creating opportunities for each other and you being supported in many ways. So be open to that and explore that. That's the second thing I would say.
Lovely. Just the last question in conclusion, I know, This podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about, again, back to your point about us reflecting on the fact that we are a unit of one, and sort of, and therefore recognizing that and playing the best game we can on the canvas that provides the opportunity for us to play the best game we can. So any one or two thoughts in summary for people to play to their potential?
I think I came across this phrase recently, which is called the infinite game, right? Mm-hmm. So when we say play the game to your potential, I think the mindset that we don't have to draw boundaries to the game that we can play. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those boundaries are actually based on mindsets that say we should do this or we should do that, or it's valuable to do this or the other.
Mm.
I think, you know, periodically just challenge those boundaries and extend the scope of how you define your game, right? And therefore play more of an infinite game, maybe not fully infinite, but it becomes an infinite game because you are not kind of boxing yourself into a predefined model of success.
Right.
Sit back and just think about what is the game you're playing and what are the rules of that game and whether there need to be these rules or if you can flex those rules.
Got it. Lovely. Thank you so much for your time, Anu. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Great to be talking to you.
Likewise.
There were three big takeaways for me in this conversation. One was the point about not prejudging an event when you don't know what you don't know. Postpone the point at which you need to take a call. Second is the point Anu makes about the fact that you're a segment of one and ensuring that you don't miss the opportunity of problem-solving the solution space within a company at the time of transition. It doesn't have to be a binary stay-go conversation. Finally, the point she makes about mentors and sponsors and the distinction she makes between them is quite powerful. Sometimes we get so busy running our lives that we miss out on some of these leaders who could profoundly shape our lives in many ways. Thank you for listening. If you found the conversation purposeful, I would request you to write a review on iTunes or share it with the people that you think could benefit from this. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.